Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Joel Morris.
I'm Jason Hazley.
As usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. And by taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we think we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is John Holmes. John is an award-winning comedy writer and performer and broadcaster. He's probably best known in this room for his work on The Now Show, Listen Against, and with Armando Iannucci. He holds the record for the largest fine ever for taste and decency offences in British broadcasting.
Still true.
And his hobby is being fired. John, welcome to the show.
I'm very good at the latter of that. I don't mind telling you. I don't know. When does a hobby become a profession? What's the cut-off? I don't know. Where one spills into the other.
It's like, thin,
you
know, line.
So you don't get paid for being fired.
Quite the opposite. As I've discovered. Yeah. It's true. It's like it's a job, but then it reverts back to being a hobby the moment you leave the building. That's how it kind of goes.
And because of that, you've got plenty of time to come on podcast.
That's right.
Exactly. How big was your fine?
Well, it was £150,000.
Did you have to pay?
No, the good Lord saw fit to make the company pay that. Wow. And they had to then cut a deal with Ofcom to go, now, you see, we didn't know he was doing this. We didn't even know he was coming in and doing a show at the weekend. We had no idea. Yeah, no, so I was called in and just said, right, there's £150,000, but we're going to let you go because we've cut a deal with Ofcom. If we let you go, they'll halve the fine. It was £75,000 as I was sort of sold, like, for that money down a river.
Yeah. I'm going to assume that taste and decency rules simply don't apply to the wild west of podcasting. So,
not at all,
so would
no.
you like to repeat what you did on the radio?
Well, it was a game of swearing radio hangman for the under 12s. That's what nailed it to the something which had been running for 6 months. We were talking about Mel and Sue just off air there, and they used to listen, because they've told me this since, on their way back from gigs. Late at night, listening to that show, which became kind of cult hit amongst comedians on their way home from gigs, because it was midnight till two or something. But anyway, swearing radio hangman. Yeah, so basically, if you've got a kid under 12, you phoned up, got the kid out of bed, and then the kid then played hangman with swear words in order to win a CD. That was the gist of it, and it all went wrong. Katie, her name was, 9 years old, and she. I'm not saying I'm proud of this. Now, but she ended up with five letters, three letters, four letters. And of course, the joy of it, the beauty of it, was that playing along at home as a listener, as an adult, you know exactly what's coming way before the kid does.
Yes.
So it's kind of your leaps ahead. And also their parents are helping, going, well, there's a P there. So you can hear them down the phone. Is there a sir? Yeah, it's the first letter of the first word. Is there a ter? Yeah, it's the first letter and last letter of the middle word, three letters. Anyway, she eventually spelled out soapy tit wank. Right, which I now know you can't really do. I mean, that on the radio, and
you live and learn, don't you?
Though, and then an old lady rang up. I remember she complained. one complaint and got Ofcom involved. And
one complaint?
One complaint, yeah, and then it all went really, really wrong. That's what 150 grand gets you.
That's, I mean, what's interesting about that is that that then leads me to not understand at all what would appeal to you about the item you've brought on to talk about today.
Yeah.
What have you brought with you?
I have brought, now this was something I grew up with. So, and when we sort of talked about this before this, in the vague brief you sent me, was something that had to be influential. That's something that influenced you in the terms of your what you eventually went on to do. Even though in 1980, when this came out, I was too young to even be considering what the hell I might do. But I just knew that I liked this album. It was in the golden era, of course, of comedy albums. Okay, so my dad had the Goodies albums and got me into that. And he had Peter Sellers and all this kind of stuff. So as a tiny child, I was familiar with this world of vinyl that's funny.
Yeah.
As opposed to the music stuff. And then along came, you know, various... was it 1973 was probably Monty Python's Matching Tie and Handkerchief, I think, wasn't it? Yeah. I didn't have it then, obviously. But I was growing up. So I, when I 1980, I would have been about 9 or 10. And I had already started. My interest in albums and comedy stuff had begun. And so I don't think I got this when it came out or anything. It wasn't like I went down there on release day. Although I now know, because I looked it up, it got to number 13 in the album charts.
Did it?
Which is remarkable, isn't it?
We're talking about Monty Python's contractual obligation
album. I probably should have said that. Yeah. and it was their first studio album since the 73 one. And what I liked about it is that it was the title wasn't a joke. It was genuinely to fulfil a contract with Charisma, I think it was.
Yeah, they're on a rock label.
Yeah.
They've got one more to do. And they've just done Life of Brian...
So yes,
broken in America. America loves them, and America loved them for their albums as much as anything. So someone said they're riding high. They've got loads of publicity about Life of Brian. We will squeeze the troop for one more record because they were contractually obligated to do one more record.
And what I loved about it was the very early on the subversive nature of that. It's a kind of okay, here we are. We've got to do this. So we're going to tell you exactly what's going on behind the scenes. Not in the title of it, and also in the fact that there's no cover of which to speak. I mean, it was just a parody of Charisma's bog standard sort of album cover, you know, the paper sleeve and everything, with "Will This Do" written on it or something like that. It's like, wow. But I didn't have that. Of course, it was art. It was the first, like, Terry Gilliam wasn't involved in this one at all either. It wasn't on the album.
It says on the front of it, could we get Terry to do something nice at the front, and someone else has written, it's not worth it. So it's got this, it looks like a bootleg.
Yeah.
Is what's interesting about it. And,
yeah.
And it, so it looks like someone smuggled it out, that you're not meant to have it.
Yeah, and I had the cassette. So I didn't, this was like, you know, boom time for cassettes here. So I would have bought it, actually I was thinking about the timeline. So I didn't, certainly didn't get it when it came out, but I would have bought it after Not the 9 O'Clock News albums.
Yeah.
So that was my first purchase, I think, as a kid. Other than the stuff my dad already had, I went out and bought the cassettes of Not the 9 O'Clock News, Hedgehog Sandwich, you know, and so forth.
Yep.
So in my then discovery of the world of funny albums, Pythons were, of course, on the list. And this one caught my eye because of the crap cover. And I was like, what is this? What's the joke here? And thus it became apparent. And what I also like about listening to it, which I know we're going to get onto, but is the fact that it's also full of jokes about things that were cut or contractual this and announcement that and all this sort of parody that turned out to be true. And I just kind of liked it.
It feels naughty in itself. It looks like it wasn't meant to exist, that it's snuck out.
Yeah.
And it's got, I mean, the thing that struck me when I looked at the cover again for the first time is this is between 73 when they've done Matching Tie and Handkerchief and all those great sort of grand, almost prog rock folly records with three concentric grooves and all those mad things. This looks like it's a bit punky, and it's sort of, it's just, it looks like a bootleg. It's not been prepared. It's not got all that beautiful airbrush art on the front. And it's between 73 and now, there's been Derek and Clive.
Yeah.
And a sort of an upswing in people circulating records that are naughty, that are dirty, that are sort of a bit, they wouldn't be on the TV. And they're circulating amongst sort of stoners out in America and rock bands and things. And this feels like an attempt to go, oh, we missed that. This is our punk record. This is our Derek and Clive. This is, and it's full of absolutely unbroadcastable filth.
Totally. I mean, it's. I mean, that's, again, that's, I think, looking back at it now, is what got me in, because there's a track called I Bet You They Won't Play This Song on the Radio. Right?
Yeah.
And at the time, you know, of that age, obviously, I didn't really know about being on the radio. And so, but that made me go, well, I'd play that on the radio if I had the wherewithal. And not long after, I did, because I went on hospital radio and played that. It was more or less the first track. Because at the end of the day, weirdly, that song is entirely playable on the radio because all of the rude stuff is bleeped out with funny noises. Yes. And so that's the funny joke, because it is, yet it shouldn't be. And it's that's...
Although you might know this, that the BBC regards a beep as offensive as a swear word.
Yeah, which is stupid.
Which is ridiculous, isn't it? Because we've tried this on radio before. We've tried to smuggle stuff in and said, it's fine, just beep it as long as we can keep the line. And they go, no, we can't keep it.
You have to refer beeps up. Just like you do with swear words. That's the.
Because the audience will imagine the swear word that's in there and put in probably a worse swear word than even you were intending.
That's what I've been told.
But this is ridiculous. In fact, it was John Cleese, wasn't it, who on I'm Sorry I'll Read That Again smuggled in the name Martha Farquhar and no one spotted it. So it went out, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You can do that. You can be as. I mean, obviously. I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue is full of unbroadcastable filth. Oh, but because they don't beep it, it's completely broadcastable.
Yeah, and that's what I don't understand about this beep thing. You go, because if I am projecting my knowledge of swear words onto a beep, how can I be offended by something that's in my own head?
You can't be corrupted.
You can't. No one's saying it out loud still.
I don't understand why the innuendo defence doesn't work for beeps, because the innuendo defence is, well, if you're imagining something smutty, that's not me doing it, that's you.
Yeah,
you
know. So why isn't that the same?
Yeah. It's strange. There's a lot of this. You can feel in this as well. They've been through a lot of legal stuff, the Python. They've just come off the back of all the fuss about Life of Brian, whether they can or can't say things. And there's a sense of them going, right, we can say anything now. We're doing songs about offence. There's one called Never Be Rude to an Arab. Basically, it's just on the edge of, I don't think it would be on a record now.
I agree. And having re-listened... which isn't even a word, but I love it when you go back and visit something you haven't heard for a long time, which I did with this, and because I haven't got a cassette machine anymore, so I had to buy it again. But the joy of listening to that, you just go, I had exactly that thought. I'd forgotten how bad Never Be Rude to an Arab was in terms of its, you know, sort of xenophobia and just, well, you know, the N-word is just there.
Dropped
there
out,
you go, bang, like that. And I'm not even saying it on a podcast for all of the reasons we know.
Correct.
But they just go, And at the time, that wasn't considered, you could just sort of put that on in the lounge with your mum and dad in the other room.
I suppose the justification is probably that the song is about offence.
Yeah.
And in order to play with that game, it says I'm accidentally or deliberately being vastly offensive again and again and again. But you still wouldn't put it on a record now, would you? You absolutely wouldn't.
This is all about something I remember being told once about. If you're going to be offensive, make sure you've got your exits covered.
Yeah.
And if you're playing with offence, and all the way through this record they play with offence, and they sort of seem to know where the fire escapes are. The strange thing, I think, is that the racial stuff, there's a song called I Like Chinese that is full of Chinese stereotypes that are entirely positive and nice. I think they're less worried about playing with racial stereotypes in 1980 than they are enjoying playing with sort of sexual material and filth. And now when you listen to it, the sexual stuff kind of just is just fun and it's a bit smutty. The race stuff is the stuff that you go, oh, you haven't covered your fire escapes. But they weren't that worried about it. You can hear they were enjoying being the frisson of it, but it wasn't a time bomb. It wasn't as dangerous as it is now. And it's interesting to hear, because this is a record that's attempting to be offensive and play with offence in the way they were going to do with Meaning of Life a few years later. They're in the middle of writing Meaning of Life when they make this. They're playing with shock comedy and what you can and can't do on the radio on records. And it's interesting to hear that the standards have changed since 1980. And now the real dynamite is under the stereotypes, whereas at the time I think it was under things like talking about gonorrhea and oral sex.
Medical love song. Yeah, you're absolutely right. But what I also thought was interesting when with I Like Chinese as well, I'm So Worried. It resonates now because the stuff they're worried about in 1980, you know, the world today is absolutely crackers with nuclear bombs to blow us all sky high. And that could have been written now. You know, that's come back. And the I'm So Worried, I mean, I'm still worried about the baggage retrieval system. That's never gone away from me.
He's right. One of the things that interested me about it was that it, even from the title, Contractual Obligation Album, to the fact it opens up with a song about oral sex, sung to sort of Gracie Fields, big choir, sit on my face and tell me that you love me. And it would be passed around. And the feeling was, this is adult. And these are grown-ups, because they've got lawyers and contracts. And there's a joke about splitting your album collection up in a divorce. And there was that thrill of going, oh, I'm eavesdropping on the grown-ups. And now listening to it as a grown-up, I go, they're being childish. Well, as a kid listening to it, it sounded like I was eavesdropping on a world of grown-ups who are worried about mortgages and divorce and nuclear war. And now I listen to it and go, they're just a bunch of grown-ups singing quite babyish songs. And it's really funny that it has both those things.
That's interesting, isn't it? You might be right. And actually, thinking about the currency of those albums at the time, and we were trading them around, you know, like, but we are listening to them as kids, and I hadn't really considered that because, yeah, but yet my dad owned them. So, you know, and he sort of, but my mum, of course, dismissed them as childish nonsense anyway.
Yeah.
So there was a real sort of
division.
But
they feel grown up.
But then, I mean, yeah, it's
my dad used to keep the Monty Python books on a high shelf. And I was pointed to them and said, you can't look at those until you're older. You'll get them like the key to the door when you're 21. So I used to, when he would go out to the pub, I'd climb up on a chair and bring them down and read them. And they were naughty. They had sort of sexual images in them and jokes about masturbation, all of which I didn't understand.
Yeah.
But it felt like a little keyhole. You're peeping into an adult world, including not only the sex and the frankness about that, but also the stuff about contracts and agents and payments and giving people checks for the business stuff. Which
well, there's
a
great
really funny
thing on contractual obligation, which is a voiceover sketch.
Yeah.
And obviously, I didn't know anything about the world of voiceover, but you know the way it's the Bishop doing doing the lager advert.
Great taste of fish.
Bishop, don't say old fish. But it's what I love about it is that I learned all I needed to know about voiceovers from that sketch, even though I didn't know what a voiceover was. You know, we're talking to you in the studio, right? That's off now, you know, and you sort of got the dynamic of how all that worked,
yes,
without knowing a thing about it. So,
and at the time, they were working, especially Cleese was working with them, they were doing a lot of advertising, so they're working doing adverts. So, this is the thing that they're very familiar with, and they're so familiar with it, they're welcoming you in saying, hey, we all know what it's like in a voiceover booth, and you go, I don't. And they go, oh, we'll show you.
Yeah.
And they say, we won't say to you at the beginning, in an advertising studio. And so they don't introduce it. They just go, you know what this world's like. And as a kid, you go, well, how flattering. Of course I know what a voiceover booth is. Of course I know what a contractual obligation is.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course I know what gonorrhea is. And it's kind of an invitation to say, do you want to put on big shoes and grow a grown-up coat and pretend you're a grown-up?
I didn't know, actually, even now, listening back, what most of the diseases in the medical love song are.
No. But now you've got them all.
But get now. Yeah, exactly. Now I'm familiar with more. But get, like I went around collecting all the video nasties when they were banned, I went around collecting all those diseases as a child. Just to sort of like, but get this. So I found this today, right? So
are we going to talk about Balanichael Shankly?
Yes, I am.
We are.
For quite a little while. This is incredible. So when I was sort of reading about the album and stuff, the BBC, who else, have done an article called Sexual Ailments in Monty Python's Medical Love Song. Written by a doctor, breaking it all down line by line and telling you exactly what each one of them is. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
education.
Because of the unique way the BBC is funded.
It's basically horrible histories.
So, yeah, it is. So, inflammation of the foreskin reminds me of your smile. An inflamed foreskin is caused by an infection called prosthesis, caused by yeast or bacteria. And it breaks it all down into detail.
That is
so
sensational.
I urge you to go and read this.
But
article.
You can tell from that, again, one of the things that Python are really good at, I think, was because obviously Graham Chapman's a doctor. So, I imagine that's him. He's written this.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
all the science in it is spot on. When the Pythons talk about philosophy, all the philosophy is spot on. When they talk about history, Michael Palin did history, didn't he? You're getting them, they're dispensing their knowledge in a way that isn't exclusive. They're not saying, I know this and you don't. They're kind of struggling and going, hey, we all know this. And that is the best form of sort of undergraduate comedy,
totally.
Is the assumption that we're all doing this course.
You know, and again, not on this album, but the Summarise Proust, or Proust, is, I didn't know what that was. Summarise what? Who? What? What do you mean? You know, I didn't, when I first thought, I barely knew what summarise meant, let alone anything else. But you sort of go, but it didn't matter because now I go, oh, okay, now I get what it is because they just
I think
okay.
It's a very helpful thing because I think that when later on you stumble upon, in a serious context, any of the things they've referred to, you're not frightened of them.
Yeah.
They give you access to knowledge in a way I used to find incredibly powerful with Python. Is that they'd refer to things in a sort of offhand way that you go, we all understand about Henry II or whatever. I know who Immanuel Kant is because of Python. They sang about
it. I think
it.
I learned most of them. I'm a terrible, lousy historian, absolutely hopeless at it. And I think everything I know about history I've learned from Python. The only reason I've heard of the Treaty of Utrecht is because two Welsh coal miners came to blows over it. Stuff like that.
You can see it gave confidence then to them writing Blackadder and things. And you realise that lots of people who know their history.
When we did Horrible Histories, right? Because I wrote on the early series of Horrible Histories for telly. And that was kind of in our heads at the time, you know. And the mantra was, it's kind of all right, look, it's okay to just go without explaining it. You just go, this is now all the facts, you know, Greg Jenner, you know, who's amazing, used to sit there and go, no, that's not factually accurate. I know it's a good joke.
He was the historian, he was the consultant on Horrible History.
Exactly. And he would say, okay, great joke, but you can't, that's not true, so that can't go in. You know, and you'd have to work a way around it. But and that's why now kids will come up and go, you know, I know about history because of Horrible Histories. It's it's almost there. It's not adult. It's got adult bits, I suppose, but it is kind of their Python in a way for that sort of, and only because we blatantly stole their idea and just went, just do it because it is, and it'll be fine.
Can I put in a slight sidebar here that my biggest and possibly only professional regret is that we were asked to write on Horrible Histories and we were too busy and didn't do it.
I literally wasn't busy. So it was fine.
You've just been fired?
I've been fired again. Yeah.
I'd love to have written on that show. It is so good. It's such a good programme. Now, advertising. It's weird that there are two sketches on this album about three tracks apart, which are both about advertising. There's The Bishop, and there's also the sketch which was for Marty Feldman.
It's a Frost Report on advertising called String, about John Cleese is an advertising guy who's helping Eric Idle offload 120,000 miles of string in 3-inch lengths, which is a terrific.
It's the line that is brilliant about it. There's a problem. There's 120,000 miles of it in 3-inch. At least the port. In 3-inch lengths. It's just that sort of. And also the phrase "to be exact." it's just thrown away, but it's so important. It's 120,000 to be exact.
It's a very old sketch. It's what's interesting. I think it was performed by the two Ronnies on the Frost Report on Advertising originally.
Yeah,
and it stinks of when they've got everyone together to do this album that on paper they don't really want to do. That John Cleese has gone, right, you can have some sketches, but they're going to be really old.
it's very odd. You can hear that. I mean, this whole album is kind of made of bits and pieces, isn't it? But you can hear the difference between that first advertising sketch, which is, come in, Mr. So-and-so, sit down, it's one of those.
Yeah.
And the second one, which is all synthesizers and it is the dawn of time and stuff like that, you know.
One of them is set in the 60s and sounds, it's set in what I call sketchland.
Yeah.
But the one with the bishop doing the voiceover is so achingly contemporary. It feels like a Not the 9 o'clock News sketch, the way that Not felt like it was not set in sketchland. It was set in real hi-fi shops and public toilets and things. You can hear that they've seen a bit of that new wave of comedy, and the new sketches they're writing are looking forward to what they're going to do with Meaning of Life, and they don't feel quite as review sketchy. And there's a sort of vigour to that.
There is
that Bishop sketch, which the other one, even though it's really funny and really well written, is a bit hoary and old-fashioned.
Well, it's like The Bookshop as well, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know, which was a previous
Marty Feldman sketch.
You know, I adored that sketch because A, it was about books, and so, you know, and I'd had heard of books, so I knew, you know, I might not have heard of gonorrhea, but I'd heard of Dickens, and I was like, Dickens with two K's. And what I loved was the playing with that. It was playing on words where there isn't any wordplay. That was what, you know, Dickens with two K's. You know, it's like that's not a double meaning. That's a thing you've deliberately. And I just love the construction of it.
It's a sort of. I think that's left over from the 1948 show, the same place as the Four Yorkshiremen came from. And there's a feeling in there, it was a character that Marty Feldman always played, and Graham Chapman's playing him on the record, who is just someone who is the most annoying person to deal with in the world, which Feldman did brilliantly in stuff. It's an exercise in writing, and you go, okay, this will be formless. There's no shape to this. We will just come up with 40 of the most annoying things he can say, and then we'll say them in.
I like to think that the whole sketch just came out of someone in a pub going, a sale of two titties. Yeah. And then from there, they went, hang on a minute. We can do something with it. And it just went on from there.
We've talked about the sketches, and there's a couple of bits of sketch work in it that feel slightly less old-fashioned. There's one where a church bells and a church comes up the path towards, which is a proper old-fashioned Python audio picture where there's the sound of bells and missiles, and it's really rich and lovely.
A beautiful noise when the window closes.
Yeah. Yes.
And it just, the bell's getting louder, like.
Close the window!
What?
I said I'll close the window!
If only we had some kind of missile, we could take the steam out of those bells.
Well, you can always use the number 14 to St. Joseph the Somewhat Divine on the Hill ballistic missile. It's in the attic.
What ballistic missile would this be then?
I made it for you. It's your birthday present.
Just what I wanted. How nice of you to remember, my pet. Here!
What?
Those bells are getting louder.
What?
Those bells are getting louder.
It's a terrific sketch. It's my favourite sketch on the album, I think. I think it's a cousin to that bit in The Meaning of Life, where Chapman is staring out of the window complaining about the bloody Catholics with filling the world up with bloody kids they can't afford to bloody feed, that thing. It strikes me that might be one of the new bits of material, the Bell sketch.
You can hear them moving their sketches on, because they don't want to do sketches anymore. They're off doing 40 Towers and ripping yarns. And I was reading Palin's Diaries, and Terry Jones is talking to Douglas Adams about maybe directing a Hitchhiker's film. They've got a million new projects to go. And someone said, will you go back and be those kids from 1969 again. And you can hear they're grudging. Cleese, clearly very grudging, is giving them some old sketches. But in that Bell sketch, you can hear is Chapman and Jones just messing about and going, oh, they still do like each other's company. They still do just like being
there's
silly.
There's an extra. Now, if you download it now, which I did, there's some extra stuff that wasn't ever on my cassette, which is an interview with Chapman and Jones talking about the making of the album. But it's very much like Chris Morris, Armando, Stuart Lee sort of interview. Yeah. So it's kind of a sort of, well, what the hell were you thinking? And they do get called up on the you know, the Chinese stuff and everything else. And the fact that most of it's unbroadcastable. And what is interesting is about they talk about writing. So it's after Brian, as you said. Yeah. So they talk about that a bit, but then they talk about they're in the middle of writing. I mean, like they said, we don't know what's going to happen with this. We've got some sketches and bits and pieces. So yeah, absolutely, that whole process was going on, and it was. I think you're right. That fascination with religion, anyway. But but the idea of them being able to sonically play with stuff and in this new wave of things, like this bell noise that gets louder, but you don't even notice it getting louder. It just creeps up on you.
It's great. It's isn't
brilliant. It? I was listening to it, picturing the guy on the fader, just going, "I've got to time this right." You know, with how loud it gets and how when it stops and when it cuts back, and then there's all the brilliant alliteration jokes in there. You know, don't practice your alliteration on me.
The shameless thing I always loved about Python is that occasionally they let you hear the type. They let you go, okay, we're doing a cheap joke here, and we're going to say we're doing a cheap joke here, but still the fun is, again, as a listener, especially as a 10-year-old, you're going, oh, I'm allowed to do that. I'm allowed to do a bunch of stuff that just amuses me, as long as at the end of it I say, I'm being self-indulgent here.
Yeah.
Which is sort of quite, again, it's quite subversive. You're not pretending this is real. You're letting people hear the process. And that was quite exciting. It was the back off the clock. Again, as a young comedy fan who might think about going into comedy, Python kept showing you how it was done.
Yeah.
Which I found exciting as a kid.
That album in particular, actually, you're right. And the fact it even starts with, you know, the announcement about the nature of comedy albums. You know, so you get the Sit on My Face as an in, and then you just get... And it was just, obviously, in the track listing, it's just called Announcement. So, and then it is just going, all right, this is a hand-tooled comedy album brought out and split up when you get divorced and all this kind of stuff. And the other little bits of it, like, because I had the cassette, so because the nature of a cassette is that, obviously, what they called side one, was shorter than side two. On the cassette, there is an announcement going, this isn't quite the end of the cassette. On the album, you could just turn over now, but you can't on the cassette. You've got to wait for it to get to the end. And then you wait 4 minutes, 52 seconds, and then it goes... That was the gap in order to... You know, beautiful.
God, they loved playing with the form, didn't they? It's Matching Tie and Handkerchief, isn't it? Which has got three sides.
Yeah.
It's an album with three
concentric
sides.
Concentric grooves.
Yeah, on one side, they cut two... concentric grooves, which apparently the mastering guy nearly had a nervous breakdown doing.
It's a thing someone called, I don't know, it might be Eric Idle, called total comedy, the idea that you cannot leave a single corner of the form or the shape of the thing without a joke on it.
Yeah.
If there's a joke to be made about how the cassette folds out. Apparently on Matching Tie and Handkerchief, Terry Gilliam was trying to work on a way of mechanically putting a spring inside the record that when you pull the record out, it would rip the cover. And it's that kind of thing. Gilliam said he wanted to do an episode of the TV show where the volume got slowly quieter and quieter and quieter. So you kept turning the volume up louder and louder so that the next show would blow the speakers of your television out. And it's like the idea they won't leave anything alone.
That's rubbed off on us all, hasn't it? Yeah. I mean, we're all like that when we write. We're just constantly trying to jam more and more things in there.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I've always liked, and it was probably going back to that, of playing with the form of whatever media you're working in.
Yeah.
You know, that and I love that, and I've done it on the radio in terms of presented shows as well as, you know, there's a thing we've been doing called The Big Debate, which they've been doing on the place I've just left. If you just tuned in, and this has happened many times where people have just tuned in and just think, well, that just sounds like the radio does, like a Jeremy Vine style phoning where two people are having a go about arguing about a thing. And we started spoofing that really early on. So we just get a couple of improv comedians to talk about to argue about unarguable things, rainbows, string, the clouds, whatever, contrails. But you treat it like it was real. So it's like, okay, well, the government have said this week that a barrel of contrails is now $150. Is that too much? And they go, well, no, you said the government aren't doing enough anyway. And but hang on, you're saying, what, 40,000 more contrails by 2019? This whole thing about things that can't be argued. Yeah. But it's that thing. It's about listening to, you have to listen between the gaps to go, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
This sounds like what it should, but underneath it really isn't what it is. And the Pythons were so good at that stuff.
Probably if I was going to say, what's the biggest takeaway I got from listening to, and don't forget the albums as well are the way that you would consume this, because they didn't repeat Flying Circus that much. And it was on very late when I was a kid. So you were studying the records to hear how these people had done it.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Pythons going, okay, this works. How does it work? And one of the way it works is what we call a bucket. Or a bucket sketch, where you've emptied all the content out of something, but the shape is still a bucket. So you can see it, you can put anything you like in it. And that came off Python. And what Python teaches you to do, if you're going to do a pastiche or empty all the content out of a debate show and put nonsense in it, is that the debate show bucket has got to be exactly like a debate show. Yeah. It's got to, from a distance, be indistinguishable from the real thing. And that comes from listening to the words people use, getting the phrasing right, the typography right, the sound right, the visuals right. People forget that about Python on TV. You look at it now and it looks a bit cheap and cheesy. But the real news looked like that. Real costume drama looked like when they did a costume drama. It was on studios. They made sure it looked exactly right. And the first thing I got from Python was, you've got to get your words right. You can't get something that sounds approximately like how a politician talks. You've got to get exactly how they talk. Yeah. And they're so precise about that.
Indeed, and it's something that is very apparent when you watch something that hasn't got it quite right, but he's trying. And you sort of go, if only you just shot it like that, it would look the same as well. When we did Listen Against on Radio 4, that was, the reason we got Alice Arnold to do that, because she was a BBC newsreader and continuity announcer.
Yes.
So and it had to sound like Radio 4.
But also exercising the typing wands of plenty of Radio 4 listeners this week was last Wednesday's food programme, in which Sheila Dillon cooked and ate a flump.
Most people think this is a nightmare to fill it, but I'm going to show you a really, really easy way to do it. Hold it by the head and they put it on a table and cut it. So they're pushing down and the knife cuts along the table so it goes right through both sides.
There it is to upset you all again.
She was absolutely brilliant at it, wasn't she?
Absolutely mind-blowing. Brilliant. Yeah, and I knew she would be because when we were looking, and for those that don't know, it was a Radio 4 series, kind of, I guess, a sort of Right to Reply feedback sort of spoof with extra bits.
Yeah.
But it had to sound, again, like if you tune in, it had to sound like Radio 4 does, but of course it was full of nonsense that sounded real. And Alice was the key to it because she just said it all in her Radio 4 voice. And I didn't want, there was a lot of arguing at the top when we first did the first series about who would present it, and of course being the BBC or a big name, let's get a big name comedian to present this, no, it will not work because it will sound like jokes, and that's not what this show is. It has to sound like it's real, but trying to explain that to executives was very difficult, and only when I got Alice in and went look, listen to her say it rather than this person you want, and they went, oh, okay.
Get the right people in. And the joy of Python was always at the level of the writing. Make sure if you're doing a sports report, you have listened to lots of grandstand, and the rhythms and the sounds of how sports reporters talk will make this funnier because you'll get it right.
On the album, there's the being eaten by a crocodile championships, which again, it's just, it's a ludicrous sentence, and you join us again at the being eaten by a crocodile Olympics or whatever it is. But of course, the rhythms all sound right. And then, it cuts to an interview like it would, except instead of discussing the hurdles, they're discussing how far you should go down its gullet.
Eric Idle ran the show for this. Usually Palin and Jones were sort of in charge of the Python records. And this one Eric Idle runs. And Eric Idle loves his songs. And he said this is his favourite Python album because it's mainly songs. What I've really enjoyed is we haven't mentioned the songs. And I'm glad because it's going to annoy Eric Idle.
What we should say, actually, but as you pointed out earlier on, is how well produced the songs are, actually, by Andre Jacquemin. That Henry Kissinger with that lovely saxophone quartet.
Yeah,
it's beautiful. It's spot on.
And whatever mic they've got him singing singing through is a really accurate... It's the closest they've ever sounded to the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. They sound like a Vivian Stanchel song with all the love that would imply. They're playing with this, and I think Idol's really enjoying being in charge of making a music record. And at this point as well, the Pythons are friends with all the rock stars.
Yeah.
They basically had their films funded by George Harrison and by The Who and Led Zeppelin, and lots of rock stars and people from the music world really like them, and Idol's enjoying hanging out with Harry Nilsson and Keith Moon and everyone. And this is a chance for them to give a record back to his mates that they can probably play after a, in a backstage after a show that's got lots of songs on it.
Yeah.
And you can hear them enjoying being able to do sort of funk pastiches and messing about.
The alarmingly funny songs on this record are the ones with Terry Jones being terribly annoying.
You can
it's
hear
very funny.
Someone said that obviously Eric Idle's the naturally musically adept one, but obviously Terry Jones really enjoys doing music and probably shouldn't be allowed
In that discussion on the extras in the modern version of this, mentioning there's a whole thing about the songs, of course. Did you enjoy doing them? And Terry Jones says, well, half of us can sing. But it's our bottom halves. Graham Chapman's legs, for instance. And they basically say, apart from Eric, hopeless. They kind of pull it off in that sort of back. You know, the medical love song, as we're talking about, has got these great sort of harmonic bits. It's sort of slightly off mic. There's a demo version on there as well with guitar and stuff. And you can hear them trying to catch up with each other. They've left it all in. And they're sort of trying to...
Oh, I've got to listen to this.
It's a sort of a throwback to, I think, sort of, they know that when they were at college, as part of like a Footlights or an Oxbridge review thing, you'd be required to do songs, whether you can sing or not. And so obviously when Eric Idle said, let's do lots of songs, and they've got experience of having been asked to do this, even though they probably can't.
Yeah.
But I love Terry Jones's response to it, which is he's got three or four songs with the same joke on this one, which is that you want them to stop as soon as possible.
I'm so worried about, whether we should just stop. And then the song just absonically stopped. I mean, the music, everything just stops dead. And then there's a gap, and he just goes, I'm so worried about whether I should have stopped then. But that's, and also, we haven't got to traffic lights yet, but it's full of those jokes whereby it's the form of when is this annoying and have we gone too far? Oh no, it's funny again. I think that was my first exposure to that sort of joke.
I love that joke. Too long is always funny.
It is.
It's the same thing as
in 1979, No One Died.
Exactly.
There's a thing in this. Someone, I never work out who said this. I keep crediting it to David Quantick, but he says he didn't say it. But someone said about Vic and Bob that the joy of Vic and Bob is that they keep taking songs that two brothers would sing in the back of a car on a long car journey to annoy their parents, and then arranging them with a full orchestra and doing them with dancers. And there's something very funny about taking a song that should have just been an annoying little hum you do on a long car journey aged about six, and then going, tell you what, we'll get in a funk band and a string quartet and we'll arrange... That joke, I don't think, is ever not funny. The annoying Terry Jones songs remind me of, songs on Shooting Stars that George Dawes does about baked potatoes. They don't deserve the effort they've been given.
It's also that excellent... When they do it and then it's shit, because that's the point, and then he just goes, perhaps it'd be better with a full orchestra. And then there is one. And it isn't. It's just, the same.
It just shits with a band now.
Listening to this on the way in, because I know this record fairly well from being a kid and listening to it a lot. I listened to it on the train coming in, and the one bit that actually destroyed me, so I was laughing embarrassingly on the train, was Traffic Lights.
Yeah.
Traffic Lights, I think, is still as funny and as annoying as I remember it. I looked at it, and it's 1 minute 58 long. And it's the longest 1 minute and 58 that's ever been recorded.
Because, again, the joy of it, the absolute unadulterated joy of it, is that you know where it's going. But it does, but you're just waiting.
Within four seconds, you know it's not going to get any better than this.
Yeah. And then not only are they're not content with it just going where you think it's going to go and belligerently doing that, they also then start messing with the form of the song itself by adding extra, the scan goes out of the window. And you can even hear them in the background, someone getting it wrong and trying to come
at
the right
with it.
Yeah, exactly. It's so good on so many levels.
It's a very single-minded thing. And that bit, I think, is almost a Dadaist. I mean, they talk about sort of Python being surreal. But the thing that's exciting about Python is they're rigorous. They're not... All the Americans who got into Python, sort of the Saturday Night Live guys and things, Lorne Michaels was really into them at the time. And they all went, hey, you guys must have been up all night. You must have been smoking something. And the point with the Pythons is they're 9-to-5 workers. Yeah. They're diligent. But occasionally there are little flashes of proper, genuine Dadaist experimental stuff, which is why they got on with the Bonzo so well. And I think I Like Traffic Lights is a piece of Dadaist art.
I mean, it is. Yes, exactly. Because you know it can only go... There are only three ways to go. There are only three verses possible. Yes. and of course we're going to leave that one till last. But by the time you get there, with, you know... I mean, for those that haven't heard it, I mean, this is... I almost don't want to spoil it. But, you know, I Like Traffic Lights, no matter where they've been. Right, okay, so we go, uh-huh.
Yeah.
I like traffic lights. I like traffic lights. I like traffic lights. That is what I said.
And then your mind is desperately going, when the first time you hear it, you go,
what rhymes?
What rhymes with that? What rhymes with the next one? And then... Oh, that does. Yeah, yes. Doesn't it, though? Yeah.
And it ends in the way it could only possibly end, which is, oh.
they get bored of it themselves.
Oh, God.
I almost want lots of other songs to end like that. Like, you know, Girls Aloud hits. You know, where there's just the whole band has gone, wake up the neighbourhood or whatever. Oh, God. At the end.
But actually, it's also the perfect song for a contractual obligation album. If you've said on the front that none of us really wanted to do this, to take the joke to its conclusion, you should climax your song. And it does, the album peaks with Traffic Lights. It builds towards it. And you go, that's the perfect joke to do on a contractual obligation album. It's just scraps. If you like Monty Python, here's some more. But I think maybe as a kid, because you're consuming it all at once, I didn't get that feeling of it being 7 or 8 years since they'd done anything sketching for records. You consume it all at once in one go, and you went, this is part of all the Python I consumed at once, included this record. So it's very hard to think of Python without Traffic Lights and Like Chinese.
Yeah, you're right.
Finland,
of course, yeah. And the Traffic Lights one, it's the go-to quote now of just my friends who all grew up with it. It's the one thing all of us, at some point, you know, just in the pub, someone will go, although my name's not Bamboo. But it's just like...
It's lovely. Also, it's
just so nice.
To hear, again, they're allowed to do... The joy of Python is they're allowed to do what they want. That's what's the rebellious thing, the thing that links them with the Beatles, which Harrison was obsessed by the Pythons being the spiritual heirs to the Beatles. What you're enjoying in Python is the sound of people who are not doing it for anyone else. That's the punky, that's the skiffly thing about them, is that they've got the means to make anything they want, and no one's telling them this won't work. Or if they are telling them this won't work, they're doing it anyway.
Yeah, because they're told they can't, they did. It is the sort of underlying...
That's the naughty schoolboy thing about it. And also, because I think when they got a lot of fuss around when they were doing the Flying Circus about people, censorship from the BBC and people seeing things in them that they weren't doing. There's a sketch where there was a note from the BBC saying, I can't believe you're broadcasting anything where a man with an enormous severed penis enters a room. And you look at the sketch and there isn't a man with an enormous severed penis. People were seeing things in it that weren't in there. And I get the feeling that their brains went, if you think we're naughty, we'll be as naughty as you think we are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's almost like the gauntlet's thrown down. And listening to this as a kid with Derek and Clive and that stuff, there's a sense of going, oh, as a grown-up, I can do what I like.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the thing that, in terms of influence of this record, is that it does feel a bit like, hey, one day, if you get into a recording studio and you've done a couple of things people like, you'll be allowed to do something as stupid as this.
Well, you say that, but then Ofcom get involved. And,
and they lied to you.
The Pythons are responsible for my failure, basically. Being fired all the time. And they owe me. The martyrdom of St. Victor, we should very briefly touch on as well.
Palin at the top of his game.
Absolutely.
Palin is so good on this record.
But the rhythms of a vicar, you know, and we'd seen Rowan Atkinson do it. But there's something about this one, and because I was a Sunday school goer at the time, I was familiar with all that world. The fact that all this stuff was happening to Victor, it was excellent. It almost pays off before... The funniest bit comes slightly before what they were
the punchline. Not the punchline. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember my dad hearing it for the first time, laughing his head off. You know, the Lord is a rotten bastard.
Again, it's a perfect bucket. That they've listened to how biblical writing, the rhythms of it, and the way that the words turn in on themselves, and then Palin's listened to how that's delivered by all the boring chaplains he had at school when he was a kid, and they've got that completely right. And then they've taken all the content out and basically put pornography in instead, which is the most basic. That's the scribbling on a Bible. That's drawing.
Sort of what the Catholics do, anyway.
They've made it dirty. But everything about it is correct.
Yeah.
They're not.
For as much as to please him.
Yeah, his hair ruffled there.
And it's because it's right that they get away with it just being dirty and filthy. And you go, that's, I think, the trick with Python, and it's a really good trick to learn that I think the South Park boys learned, is that if you do it really well and you're really clever and you're evidently clever and you've been paying attention and you've got all your homework right, you can be as dirty as you like.
Yeah.
And Parker and Stone have said that Python were a huge influence on the Book of Mormon because they liked the songs. And they really like this album. They like Lumberjack Song and things. And the idea of saying, you've done all the work, you've done your revision, you've done your homework, you've been listening, so we'll get everything right. And because we've got everything right and we've done our job as comedy writers really well, we can now be quite childish. But you can't say we're childish because this is quite clever.
Yeah, yeah, you're absolutely right. And it, I think that was the joy. And I think you hit it earlier when you said that it was listening to it through a child's ears, it sounded adult.
Yeah.
And listen to it now and it sounds a little bit sharp, but that's kind of the magic of it. That's not an accident either. I think, as you said, that they've worked for that, and that's fair enough.
They've earned it.
You know? Yeah.
How lovely. What a brilliant thing to listen to again. Thank you so much for bringing us
You're more
Monty
than
Python's contractual obligation record.
You're
and
very
thanks
welcome.
For being on the show, John Holmes.